so many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello, and welcome to Geekwilly Yoke, the world's best married Christian geek podcast. As always, I'm Lehman Kessler.
And I'm Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Rachel Kessler.
I'm a priest here in the Anglican Diocese of Toronto and a PhD in medieval literature, which makes me a giant nerd.
And I'm an invited guest at the H.P. Lovecraft Necronomicon in Providence, Rhode Island. And I'm a huge nerd. So it has been a bit of a while since our last time we got together with Errol. How has your geek fourth night? I don't know what the equivalent of a fourth night plus 1 week is. Threef night? Fifth night? Twelfth night?
Well, fortnight comes from the 14 night, right?
Okay.
So it'd be like a 21th night?
Oh, yeah. 21. Oh, wait, we're in Canada, so 21
we're
doesn't matter.
So that's very anticlimactic.
Fair enough. How's it been, Rachel?
I don't even know. Like, what have we been doing?
We did travel to South Carolina.
Which is always...
magical?
Magical.
We ate a lot.
Oh, my goodness. I ate nothing but fried chicken and barbecue for, like, a week.
Oh, don't forget that we ended it with pizza.
Oh, yes, pizza. And all of the, like... multiple desserts.
There were a lot of desserts. Like, so
every time we thought we were done with the desserts, they would come out with more desserts.
Well, there had to be a special dessert for every night because there was constant things we were celebrating.
But then there were there would be the dessert for that night, and then they would come out with the special dessert for that night for what we were celebrating. There was so much dessert
and lots of ice cream.
Seriously, my mother's freezer is like a Baskin Robbins.
That was pretty impressive.
No one needs that much ice cream.
It was a lot of ice cream. We've got three little tubs of frozen yogurt.
Yeah,
so.
But that's only because we forget to throw out the tubs that have, like, just one little spoonful left in them.
I think they're mostly
ice crystals. We're just those really sad people.
We are totally prepared for parenthood. We had the first of our baby showers.
Oh, yes. There was a lot of yellow.
There was a lot of yellow. I am so upset because I've been telling people and dropping hints that Star Wars is unisex, but so far...
But have you met my family? Do you honestly think they're going to go Star Wars? Do you think that my family is going to go shop for baby stuff on the Think Geek store?
They should.
Have you met my family?
We need a registry there.
We also sprang forward in the technological world over the last few weeks.
Oh, that's right. We have
entered 2009.
We have. We now own smartphones.
From 2009.
But they're so smart-ish.
They might be more than 2009 smartphones.
And not only do we get to go over the smartphones, but now we have our first tablet as well.
Indeed. We got an iPad.
And I've immediately made Rachel get Space Team for it.
Which I refuse to play with you in an airport. Or really any public space.
It was best in an airport or public space.
No.
Space Team is a pretty amazing game. You shout instructions at each other, and if you're in a public space,
I think the best. The best was that you then showed Space Team to my gaggle of small, like, cousins.
Yeah.
And for which I'm sure their parents are profoundly grateful to.
Look, I saw four little kids who each had their own iPhone, and I saw opportunity.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's been
pretty much it. Yeah.
We
got to use American Netflix, which was a glorious thing.
I think you took more advantage of that than I did.
That is possible. Oh, and I got Lego Lord of the Rings.
Right.
Which was also a thing of beauty.
I think my favorite part about our iPad was how every time our 18-month-old nephew saw it and saw the picture of Bilbo on the lock screen, he would just pick it up and start barking at it.
This would be Bilbo, our dog, not
Bilbo
Martin Freeman.
Fagnes. That's true. Yes.
Yes. The small child going, oof,
oof, oof,
oof, was pretty adorable. Pretty adorable.
The tablet is the world's most expensive baby toy, let's be honest.
Well, it's just ridiculously amazing how they intuit it and just, like, you know, poke, poke, poke and slide, slide, slide. And just they immediately understand what's going on there. It's crazy.
We managed to prevent him sending an email to our friend Andrew.
It could have been a thing of beauty.
Anything else you've been up to?
No. Well, yes, but that's probably something we're going to have to say for a future episode.
I'm intrigued.
I've been having my own lady chains yanked recently.
Oh, please, let's not go down this dark corner of the internet.
We're going to talk about this later.
You have to at least mention what you've been... Now that you've brought it up...
All right. I'm not going to go into a full thing because I think that this is better for its own discussion. But I...
Dark corners of the internet. You are a sick and twisted person.
I have become somewhat fascinated by what is colloquially known as the manosphere. Websites and blogs devoted to sort of a bizarre combination of men's rights activists, pickup artists... the involuntary celibate, men going their own way, and now there's the whole sort of red pill community, which I've infected Rachel with.
Oh, I hate you so much.
But we're going to get into that later. Mostly, just know that it's frightening and it's weird, and it's like when I discovered, you know, horrible right-wing racist websites in, like, the late 90s and thought, oh, so this is what the internet's for. Crazy people getting together and being
of course.
Crazy.
And my argument is, what good does it actually do to know that these crazy people exist?
It helps us prepare. But... we will save that for another time.
All right, so what are we talking about today?
Today we're going to be looking at morality and, to a degree, sort of self-censorship.
Mm. That sounds deep.
Yes.
Probing. Introspective.
So in lieu of having an episode last week, I asked folks sort of what they thought might be an interesting discussion or theme. And our good friend Rachel Kolar, who makes up a good fifth of our listenership, asked about... decisions on what kind of characters you want to play in a role-playing game based on your Christian background or your morals or ethics and things like that. And I thought that was very interesting because I really haven't allowed my Christianity to stop me from playing horrible characters. But it got me thinking about sort of self-censorship in general. So I figured we can kind of start on the gaming route and then kind of explore. I mean, we've looked at how Christian culture kind of polices itself and sort of rejects elements of pop culture. But I figure we can look at a sort of, you know, look beyond just the kind of the macro of Christian culture and look at how our families dealt with it and how we ourselves have dealt with it. So we'll start with gaming. I mean, gaming I got into largely because of my brothers were into gaming. So, you know, it was something that was just always around. And I didn't really think of it as something apart from Christianity or apart from... in the same way that
aside
there was...
aside from the time that visiting missionaries burned all of your brother's gaming books?
I think... well, see, that was... but they got all those gaming books from another missionary.
Right.
So it seemed like this sort of, like, just sort of separate thing. You know, like sci-fi fantasy novels or, like, drinking or something right. like that. You know, it was this kind of element that some people were upset with, but not my family.
Right.
And so, as a result, you know, I started gaming with them in a kind of safe environment. And, you know, my characters were... started off usually pretty kind of jokey. I mean, I was a kind of a loon gamer, the sort of selfish actor type who just wants a lot of attention and makes their character as weird as possible and not particularly useful in a gaming environment.
Yeah, I remember playing Star Wars with you and your former Imperial TIE Fighter officer.
Who was really fat.
That was and really... you were incredibly useless.
Except when we needed a pilot and I was amazing. I was like, Wash?
I just remember...
if Wash had, like, severe PTSD... I think I even had Hawaiian shirts.
I just remember the time that we made the unfortunate decision to split the party.
Ugh.
So I was playing a Jedi?
Yes.
Or something? And it was... I was stuck in a room with you and our sad... like, basically you as this sad former Imperial TIE Fighter pilot... and our tech specialist, who is basically a sadder version of Kaylee.
Yeah.
Also played by our good friend Rachel Kolar.
That's right. Was she a little bat creature?
She was a little bat creature, yeah.
Wasn't she specifically the little bat creature that whines for, like, the cup
yes,
of milk?
Yes, precisely. She was exactly that. And I had a room full of stormtroopers to fight. And not only did I have to fight them all single-handedly, I do recall your character decided to go up to them and start singing the Imperial National Anthem.
Yes, I think I was trying to defect. It was very complicated. But was I more or less useful than Tom's character, Rachel's husband, who was our Ugnaught kind of face? Like, he was the guy who sort of handled our contracts. But mostly what he did was get us paid three different ways from, like, three different factions, but then pocket all the money.
No.
That was a somewhat dysfunctional group. I've played sort of quirky characters like that, but I've also played incredibly sort of dark characters as well. You know, I have not shied away from all kinds of different elements of gaming. I think the darkest character I played was in this really weird kind of fantasy GURPS game. He was kind of a quasi necromancer scientist. And I think the height of creepiness was when I introduced his quote unquote sidekick, which was a little girl named Alice, who instead of arms and legs had just sort of giant sailor arms, and sort of skittered about like a spider. So
that was. So you're saying that your Christianity has had no impact on the characters you play?
Well, I don't know if I've ever met anyone who's sort of outright blasphemous, I guess, but it doesn't enter into it. Like, it just seems like a sort of separate thing.
I'd say the only time that it was an issue for me was when I was playing vampire.
Oh, okay.
That's the only time, because I mean, everything else was, I think much like you, my characters tend to be borderline ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, and that was also a very, your vampire, specifically it was the vampire middle, Dark Ages?
Yeah, or? Dark Ages.
So you were in a kind of very
real. Well, and if our good friend Andrew is listening to this, hi Andrew, there is a not insignificant degree to which he was using that vampire game to like
explore his rediscovery of Christianity.
Yes, exactly.
I think as our good friend Andrew Crabtree put it, the church started getting more and more powerful the more and more reconciled
we encountered a lot more people who had true faith.
Indeed.
As Andrew came more to terms with his own Christianity. And then there was also the fact that Andrew would spend all of, you have to understand, dear listeners, that here in Toronto, we have arguably the world's greatest medieval studies library.
Yes.
We have the Pontifical Institute of Medieval Studies with an exceptional collection of materials on the medieval church specifically.
All guarded by grumpy monks?
They're Basilian friars.
Oh, okay.
Fathers, not friars. Yes. But they are very precise about the way in which one should handle the books and not photocopying the folios, which everyone does. You just have to make sure no one's looking.
Right.
I probably shouldn't be talking about this. Anyway, but he would spend hours in this premier medieval studies institution researching maps of 13th century London for his Dark Ages vampire game. You'd walk along and you would spend excruciating detail of the layout of these churches that you were going into and stuff like that.
It sounds like having Umberto Eco as your GM.
Kind of. A little bit. We love you, Andrew. Vampire was the one time where, like, okay, I'm actually playing a creature of darkness.
Yeah.
I'm not comfortable,
participating in the sort of darker elements of it?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was really that's the only time I can really remember being intentional about crafting my character in a way that I was like, okay, I want to be comfortable with this. So I played, like, as close, because there were some, like, within, especially Dark Ages Vampire, you can have some vampires who are, like, sort of quasi-Christian, which
the morality gets sort of bizarre.
It's really weird. But I didn't want to do that either, because that felt like sort of an adulterated version. That felt even more twisted.
Yeah.
So I played as secular a vampire as I could.
Oh, okay,
right?
Gotcha.
Like, and
I think you were a bruja, right?
I was a bruja, which meant that occasionally I could frenzy.
Yes.
Which was just like, it was almost animalistic.
Yeah.
Right? And I got into a bit of a kerfuffle with another player who accused me of playing Joss Whedon vampires instead of Anne Rice vampires.
I was about to say, you would get into like these bizarre ontological debates with people about like the nature of like your vampirehood.
Well, that was also because of Andrew. Because Andrew would, like, my character, because we were a bunch of medieval studies graduate students playing Dark Ages vampire, right?
Yes.
Like,
Are you saying there might be a risk of overthinking this thing?
Maybe a little bit. Just don't play a game set in the Middle Ages with a handful of PhD candidates in medieval studies, is all I'm saying. But, I was playing a sort of scholar, like, my character was a medieval scholar.
Okay.
Of sorts, and so then Andrew would, like, force me to get into these, like, role play these academic lectures on
Aquinas
and Aristotle and like the hylomorphic unity of the vampiric soul within the human body and all of this stuff. And I'm just like,
gaming is quickly becoming homework.
Exactly. It was not that. It was actually... it might have been that game where I actually... No, it was a different World of Darkness game when I actually started pulling out my Norse vocabulary and I was, like, doing my Norse homework during gaming. But that's another question. Yeah, but I think playing a character that was, for the most part, you know...
disconnected from the...
Yeah, and then when I did go crazy, I could go just really, really crazy, and it was almost animalistic as opposed to...
a conscious sort of sociopathic... conscious,
yeah, that was the way I reconciled that, but I haven't really had a lot of experience, like most of my gaming experience, and I'm not like a super gamer. I enjoy gaming that is more whimsical rather than dark. Which is why I stopped gaming a whole lot with our gaming group in Toronto, just because the sorts of stories they wanted to play out weren't necessarily the stories that I wanted.
Yeah, well, they were going into more sort of dark cinematic kind of noir stuff. I tend to, as Itchik, as a GM, I've discovered my two main flavors are darkness and whimsy. Those are sort of the two things I sort of go for.
You're not so much darkness as creepy.
I do go for a lot of creepiness. I do like monsters made out of scissors and things like that. Mm. And it's interesting because I do use a lot of theology, or at least I really enjoy exploring religions in games. Cleric is probably one of my favorite classes. Mm. I've played necromancer, sort of necromantic clerics who, are exploring the nature of death when kind of more contemplative, kind of, monk types, or scholar priests. But in games where I GM, I really like exploring the notion of deity and godhood. And I like looking at how a system deals with its gods. Cause, in sort of generic Dungeons and Dragons, it's this kind of very generic sort of pantheon, and everyone sort of accepts casually that there are gods, and you can sort of see their handiwork, but you sort of pick them along kind of party lines or racial lines, or sort of like, well, I'm a fighter, so I worship the god of fighters. And it gets very banal very fast, and sort of like, I objectively know the address of where my god is. Like, if I get on the right plane, I can go visit them. I think I really enjoyed doing in the last major D&D game that I ran was there were multiple gods. People, had their gods and religions, and I actually had my players kind of define a lot of their religions, mm-hmm. And describe them for me. But I didn't tell them which ones were objectively true, and told them that, all of your faiths believe your god is the one true god, and everyone else's god is a demon or some sort of outside force or a pretender. And so there's no objective reality. It's not like a pantheon of gods. It's these competing forces.
Yeah.
And I like that a lot more because it let people feel really invested in their gods.
Yeah.
And feel like their gods mattered. And we had a lot of fun. Andrew Crabtree, a different Andrew, mm-hmm. who was also in your vampire game, he had a wonderful character who was the last angel of a dead god.
Mm.
And there were several other deities who potentially were the heirs of his god.
Oh.
And he was sort of trying to figure out, like, is this divine spark present in them, but not really attracted to any of right. the gods. Right. I also had a lot of fun because I sort of had D&D Anglicanism. I had the most powerful, like the most powerful widespread religion be the only one where the priest didn't get spells.
You get spells in Anglicanism.
But it was this idea of this established sort of church that was, although I think I did have like a priest talk about like, I may not be able to cast spells, but I bury people and I, baptize the young and I provide hope and, in darkness and things like that. And that was my little sort of like, you don't need spells to, be a true religion. Maybe that says something about my thoughts on like sacramentology and whatnot.
Yeah, maybe that's a conversation for another day.
But no, I mean, I really haven't, limited myself as far as kind of what I'm willing to GM or write about. Obviously, I don't necessarily, want my players participating in genocide constantly.
And I think gaming is an interesting example of how your faith comes into the types of media you consume, because you're engaged with it in a much more active way than what you're reading or watching or.
But it's very very reflective of your media, right? Exactly. Like, you know, my stuff plays out like the kind of the fantasy novels I read or the other games I've been in. Like, it is, you know, it's with the gaming, you really are letting your brain kind of vomit out all of this stuff. And Christian role-playing games and role-playing games based in a sort of...
Testament!
There's Testament, which is a game that sort of uses elements of the Old Testament to kind of flavor it. And, you know, you can play as, like, I'm a fourth-level harpist.
Yeah.
And things like that. And we never got that off the ground, but it was interesting to sort of see that. And there's a fascinating game that was part of a Kickstarter, which I'm interested because it's a Kickstarter I supported, called Hillfolk. And the idea is you play Iron Age sort of tribespeople in the Palestine area during the era, essentially, that, you know, the Bible is taking place in, and sort of how, and it's not explicitly a religious game, but it's, you know, like, this is some place that we see a lot of stories out of. And this sort of game is about exploring, making your own stories and kind of figuring out how you want to play with that. Do you want to be sort of a raiding party? Do you want to sort of try to kind of potentially move towards the Kingdom of David sort of stuff? But I found it interesting that that's where he's decided to set it, you know, and base it. But there are, like, also, you know, Christian role-playing games where you either are, like, playing during the apocalypse and you're, like, Christ's holy knights, you know, going about fighting the forces of the Antichrist. I guess there's somewhere in some dark corner of the internet is probably a Left Behind role-playing game.
One can only imagine. Isn't there a Left Behind video game?
There is a Left Behind video game. That is very true.
Well, and I think your point that there is this overlap between what we create in gaming and what we consume in our other media, right? And I think maybe that's the place to take the conversation now. Like, you know, we come from very different backgrounds in terms of how our parents governed our media consumption when we were growing up.
Although I think we both saw examples of it, because my parents, even though they were pretty lenient, I still had examples of other missionary parents who were much more sort of like stringent.
And I think it is that question of how you draw those lines in what you consume.
And what battles do you want to fight?
Yeah, what battles do you want to fight? And I think just what, you know, if one has a worldview shaped by a particular faith, that's just on some subconscious level, I think, going to impact what you particularly want to
view and expose yourself to. That makes a lot of sense.
And so I think maybe that's the... So do you want
to... Yeah, so I can talk about my own experience. I mean, with my family, it was interesting. Because, you know, I'm thinking about growing up in West Africa and the sort of the media I had access to. And I recall watching things like Name of the Rose and Doctor Strange Love. And I think I remember watching, like, Witness with my family. I think that Witness and No Way Out were the only two movies I ever watched with my family where they made me, like, close my eyes or, like, leave like the doorway. And it was the murder scene at the beginning of Witness, the Amish murder movie with Harrison Ford, for anyone who was not a child of the 80s. and then the sex scene in No Way Out in the back of the limo, which I mostly remember because of a Mad Magazine article making fun of it, which is how I get most of my pop cultural information. But yeah, for the most part, they really didn't censor a whole lot. Although it was interesting because when we got back to the States, I remember the two shows that my mom did not like, and one she didn't like me watching was Simpsons.
I still feel transgressive when I watch the Simpsons. I'm 31 years old.
And the other one that she actually, I think, forbade me watch, one of the few things I think I was sort of, like, flat out told no to, was Married with Children. And they were both for the same reasons, was that she didn't like the way they treated each other as a family. Mm. She didn't like the kind of the snarkiness and the meanness. I mean, you know, we were watching ridiculous amounts of murder-based shows on, like, Mystery and Murder, She Wrote and things like that. So, like, violence wasn't as big an issue. Even to some degree, sex stuff wasn't as big an issue. But when it came to, like, sitcoms, you know, she really was upset by the notion of people being mean to one another. Mm. And that, I guess, that being a kind of, like, family example.
Yeah.
So I was just thinking about it because I think about, like, oh, you know, I watched everything. But I realized, no. There were things that they did sort of put their foot down on.
Whereas I grew up in your stereotypical family, which, actually, I mean, I shouldn't say that because I know, like, my sister-in-law's family, I mean, she couldn't watch anything.
Yeah.
I mean, she talked about how she watched John Wayne movies with her father.
Yes.
And that was about it. And so, I mean, we weren't, my family wasn't that conservative. Like, we certainly, I certainly watched Star Wars and
Well, and you were watching Disney. Like, they were not completely disconnected.
Yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. But there, things were definitely monitored.
Yes.
In terms of what we could watch. Curse words were bleeped out of movies. If it looked like anyone was going to have sex, the thing got turned off.
Yeah.
Nothing where anyone was living together before they were married. I remember my mother getting outraged when Sleepless in Seattle came out, and the associate pastor at our church referenced it in a sermon.
Okay.
And my mother was outraged that how would this pastor is condoning a movie where people are living together before they're married.
Oh, poor Bill Pullman. He just can't catch a break.
He just couldn't win in that movie.
Nope.
So, I mean, that was just absolutely not accepted. And I remember Back to the Future. We rented Back to the Future one night, and we turned it off halfway through because my mom thought there was just way too much swearing.
Oh, yes.
In it. The stereotypical conservative American family, violence was not as big an issue.
No.
Right? So, I mean, I remember going and seeing, being taken to see Glory.
Oh, wow.
I don't know how old I would have been when that came out, but I was taken to see that in the theater, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
And that was pretty intense.
That's an intense movie.
Yeah.
That's got some mature themes.
Yeah. But I would say swearing and sex.
Those are the things that were sort of...
Absolutely. And anyone using taking the Lord's name in vain. That was like the biggest.
Yeah.
No. But we were pretty... I remember my brother's greatest regret of his childhood, and he feels like absolutely robbed as a child of the 80s.
Yes.
He was never allowed to watch Goonies.
Oh, right.
And he I think he is bitter about it to this day.
Well, that's fair enough.
And then there are some movies that I,
Well, there's sort of gaps in your kind of movie watching that still surprise me to this day. Like the fact that you've never seen Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Oh, that was like, Jessica Rabbit was like, she was the whore of Babylon.
Whereas I was watching that with other like missionary folks.
No. Oh my goodness. Like no.
Indeed.
I'm trying to think of other things like, well, I mean, there was definitely E.T., but we had watched E.T. so many times that it was one of those movies that my parents
got a
knew
pass.
They knew where all the...
penis breaths were?
Yes, and could mute them out.
Very nice.
There were many classics that a lot of other really conservative... I think my parents were seen as actually lenient.
Okay.
Excessively lenient compared to other families in our church, which astounds people when I explain that to them now, but... and I think about, like, the stuff that I was able to read.
Well, that's the other thing,
like, this
thing,
is
right?
A really interesting thing to me, is my parents were quite strict on TV consumption. Like, I was not allowed to watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
No.
And we're talking, this is high school, right? Like, this was when I was in high school. And Buffy, ads for Buffy would come on when my mother was watching Seventh Heaven.
Yes.
And it was just, that was a demon show. You cannot watch that. Buffy was a year ahead of us in high school, or maybe 2 years ahead of us in high school.
So
something like that.
So yeah, so like.
So it was in its maybe fourth season when we went
to undergrad.
No, it must have been.
It would have been fifth season.
Seventh season was in our third. Yeah, it would have been fifth season when we were. Yeah. Anyway, so I didn't get into Buffy until the sixth season.
Yeah, well, it was the musical.
It was the musical. Well, it was our friend Tom who. Evangelized me with the Buffy the Vampire Slayer musical. But I mean, that I felt horribly. Like, that was my great college rebellion. I ate Count Chocula for breakfast and started watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Star Wars role-playing games.
Right.
So it's interesting that they were so strict about what I was watching, but I got away with reading all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
And the only thing that my parents ever took away from me when I was reading was Slaughterhouse-Five.
Oh, because your dad actually knew what was in
it. And I think that's the thing, right? Like, they weren't watching what I was reading because they didn't... Like, my parents had no exposure to sci-fi and fantasy.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Like,
But they didn't categorically sort of deny it, which, I mean, you do sometimes
see. And I think to my parents' credit, they... Yeah, I think they just didn't know what was in a lot of that stuff. And to their credit, I think they realized if they just stopped letting me read any of these things, that it would be a much bigger problem.
Yeah, they would be drawing more attention to it, or making
in the
it...
end, yeah. And I think because we were a family that was we were allowed Disney at least.
Yeah.
And I know other families in the church that wouldn't even let their kids watch Disney movies because that was too much magic.
Yeah.
Quite apart from this was back in the 90s when the Southern Baptist Convention was attempting to boycott Disney for the gay pride stuff.
Until they discovered that Disney owned ESPN.
Yeah. Let's not go down that road. But I certainly knew families who, you know, you couldn't even watch Cinderella because a fairy godmother was potentially satanic.
It was pagan.
I think that's really... I appreciate that.
No, there's...
But I do think there was a lot that I got away with reading that they would not have let me read had they known what was actually... Like, had they known that I was reading books with explicit sex scenes in them...
Yeah.
I think they would have...
Been a bit more vigilant.
Yeah.
Did it help maybe that your brother wasn't like a huge reader, so they didn't have like practice? Like,
probably.
There you go.
Probably.
See, yeah, because we had all sorts of books in the house. And
I think their thought was, books are good. Books are, she's reading. Hey, that's great. But yeah. I remember being on, when I was abroad junior year.
Yeah.
And then I was in England and I went over for 3 weeks to a camp in Hungary.
Oh, yeah.
Camp in Hungary. That I was teaching English at this Christian day camp. And it was a super, 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 super conservative camp. Like, I ended up being deeply uncomfortable there. And this one person found a copy of Carpe Jugulum.
Oh.
In my bunk and was
Terry Pratchett's a vampire novel for those who don't know.
And it had this picture of vampire, like cartoon vampires and witches on the front. And they were like, do you really think that's something that you should be reading? And then they found my Harry Potter playing cards. And
well,
it's all done.
Harry Potter's its own weird.
Well, and I think the funny thing is, like, the reason I got started reading Harry Potter was because I was working the summer after first year of university. I was working in the daycare at my church.
Oh, right.
And we were explicitly told if we saw a kid reading Harry Potter, we had to confiscate it.
Right.
And I was like, this was like 2001.
2001, yeah.
Yeah. I was like, this cannot be that bad. I refuse to believe that Harry Potter is that bad. And I was like, no, in fact, Harry Potter is not that bad.
Well, it's so fascinating because I remember I had a non-Christian friend who was asking, like, why do Christians care about, like, Harry Potter? And, like, they don't actually think kids are going to become witches and, like, warlocks. And I had to sort of set him aside and say, well, some of them do.
Yeah.
It's not because they think it's fictional that they have a problem with it. It's because there are some folks who, for them, this is a reality or a gateway to a kind of reality.
Well, and I think this is where I think the conversation is very interesting, because I do think that it might be prudent to have some degree of discretion in terms of what we consume.
Yeah.
As Christians, but I also think that you miss something more important if you're just like, oh, people are having sex. No. Oh,
yeah.
there's magical activity. No. Because there was a really great article way back in the day when season 6 of Buffy was going on.
Oh, okay.
And Buffy and Spike started into their very sexual, very like...
unhealthy.
S&M.
Yeah.
Relationship. And
invisible sex.
Yeah, oh, that was a bad episode. But there was the first episode where they have sex. They have sex in like they're beating each other to a pulp, and they have sex in a house that they're basically destroy.
Klingon style.
Klingon style sex. And there was a great article that was saying that Buffy was one of the shows that was dealing with sexuality in the most mature way.
Yeah.
On television, because it was showing the destructive aspect of this sexual relationship, and I think that's true. The whole point of Buffy and Spike's relationship in season 6. Yeah, it's incredibly explicit. And if you were my parents when I was in high school, they would not have wanted me to see that because there is some fairly blunt sexual content to it. On the other hand, it also shows how destructive that was personally for Buffy.
And the sort of the message winds up being much more wholesome than maybe, say, Twilight, where there's no sort of actual sex.
Yeah, but no, absolutely.
But the sexual, like, lessons are still awful.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So I think Buffy shows a much, you know, in this idea that Buffy is using this other person for sex because she is so depressed and in such a bad place in her own life.
Yeah.
And she hates herself for doing it, but she can't stop.
Okay.
And eventually realizes that she is destroying herself, and she cuts it. She breaks it off. But
and then has a really lame final season.
Well, we don't talk about that. But yeah, I mean that I think by you just say, well, this is a show that shows people having sex, and so you shouldn't be watching it. You actually miss out on a chance to have a more interesting conversation around sexuality.
Well, and that's what's been going on. I know there was a big controversy a while back with John Green's novel. Because
mm-hmm.
John Green had a young adult novel where, again, there was a scene of sex, which got sort of certain parent groups kind of up in arms, and they started to try to have it banned from school reading lists because they thought it was pornographic. And he sort of made the point, like, if you actually look at the sex scene, it's pretty much showing the problem of engaging in these kind of, like, you know, relationships sort of before people are ready, and, like, it's not meant to be erotic or titillating.
Yeah.
It is the opposite of pornography. It is making you think.
But at the same time, this is a conversation you and I have had many times. There are things that I have no interest in watching, and I don't know if it's just because of what my tastes are, or if it is somehow based in my faith, but the fact that I have no desire to watch Breaking Bad, right?
Yeah, you don't like sort of banality and like the degradation of people, like,
no,
based on just their series of compromising choices.
No, and I mean, and maybe I'm making the same mistake. Maybe Breaking Bad actually allows for a deeper conversation about those moral compromises that a person makes ostensibly for good reasons, which actually ends up destroying their soul.
No, precisely.
I mean, absolutely. But there is just something in that level of bleakness that I just have no desire to engage in.
To participate in.
And, I mean, obviously we are both people of faith, and you love it to a disturbing degree. And
you,
so
like Mad, you like Mad Men.
Well, and this is interesting. So this is a conversation that I actually got into with a girl at church. And we were talking about this, and because she was saying that she couldn't deal with Breaking Bad.
Oh, okay.
And those, all of those things that you love, people descending into their own mediocrity.
Yay.
and despairing, nihilistic attitude towards human life.
No. See, the best is people making moral compromises for what they think are noble goals, but, and especially when they were sacrificing their family for their family or for their idea of their family and about Schmidt.
Let's not talk about Schmidt. Anyway, we were just talking about how we couldn't deal with that, but that we both sort of, despite ourselves, liked Mad Men.
Yeah. Mad Men's pretty.
But, well, Mad Men is pretty, but that there is, like, the thing about Mad Men is there's almost like this longing for something more in the characters.
Yeah.
Like,
they're aspirational.
That there is, like, they're almost, like, sad about the fact that their lives are so depressing.
Mm.
Or that, you know, Don Draper wants something.
It's really,
there's something that he has a desire for something.
In the later seasons, and we're on Netflix time, so
we're a year behind everything.
I think in these later seasons I'm seeing more of that. In the first season, it's pretty much just like,
yeah,
I am wallowing in my own sort of just
decadence
and and running from a past that keeps catching up.
But
with
I got
me.
To a point with Mad Men where I couldn't take it anymore.
That's
we
true.
Didn't watch it for a while.
Yeah. You sort of
I was like, I can't deal with this anymore. And then we sort of went back to it.
Yeah.
I mean, then we have the question of things like Game of Thrones.
Well,
does one deal with the sexuality and violence in Game of Thrones?
Well,
is that something that we just kind of, we like it so much?
You just give it a pass?
And
well,
it a
and
pass,
I mean,
or?
And it's, in some way, I mean, Game of Thrones is interesting, right? Because it is, in some way a giant cartoon, right? I mean, yeah. You know, the violence is so kind of like ultra violent. And I remember when I first read it, I was like, wow, this is a fantasy novel where people are swearing and like people are like dying of like sepsis. Like, this is so adult. Like, this is such a mature like piece of fantasy. And sort of as I've...
Well, as you read it, you're like, this is laughable.
Like, well, there's a certain degree of like adolescent fantasy. There's a lot of like buxomness and...
I probably should not in this public forum talk about George R. R. Martin's inability to write a sex scene from a female perspective.
Yeah.
Maybe that's not a conversation we need to go into.
That'd be maybe a lady chain for another day. And yeah, and it almost has that same kind of feeling of DC Vertigo, you know, like kind of the Sandman and the Preacher, where they're like, these are comics for adults, which means we're going to have some nudity and some swearing. I mean, yeah. The Sandman managed to actually, you know, have complicated storylines, but there was sort of an idea of, as Marvels were trying to be, you know, or as comics were trying to be sort of quote-unquote adult, that mostly just meant they would, like, drop F-bombs from time to time.
Well, and you mentioned the whole giving Game of Thrones a pass because we like it. I mean, the funny thing is you have witnessed my mother doing this.
Yes.
That as much, you know, I remember showing her an episode of Scrubs where... there is some mention of someone having had sex at some point, and it was like...
Up in arms,
and I can't believe you're watching this show. And she watches her, like, Roseanne and her Cheers and Reba.
Well, you know, it was the 90s. It was a more innocent time.
No, but but she'll comment on, I know they're talking about stuff that I wouldn't approve of, but and it's that always, I know it's doing XYZ, but...
Yeah. Well, and these things do have a certain context to it, right? I mean, that's why dismissing things out of hand is so problematic, or having these kind of categorical, I will not have anything to do with any kind of media that includes this.
Yeah.
You know, you can, you know, miss out on potentially really fascinating, good pieces of culture. And, in my opinion, maybe even more problematic, you can miss out on the conversation being had about it.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I find to be very fascinating. And that's why I tend to gravitate towards, I don't know, the awful things. It's because I like the discussions that can spring up around them.
Well, and I think you're willing to have those discussions.
Yeah. Now, there is, I know, at least one sort of set of novels and an author who we will never have any agreement on.
Oh, is this China Mieville?
This will be China Mieville.
I hate China Mieville so much.
But he's so good.
Oh, he's the worst.
He's so compelling. And
he's terrible, and all of his characters are horrible people.
His characters are usually horrible people, and the ones who aren't horrible are usually, like, tortured awfully until they die.
It's true. So what does that say about us?
Well, you know, and I think that, you know, China Mieville, I think, sits at the perfect epicenter of our, you know, our disagreement over art and over, like,
so
you know,
true.
Media and things like that. Because, you know, in some ways he is a lot like... a Gaiman or a George R. R. Martin, you know, like you can see a lot of the same qualities.
It's like Gaiman if you just sucked away all the whimsy and took that energy to make Gaiman's creepier like 10 times worse.
I always like to say it's like Pratchett and Gaiman had a child and then abused him.
And took out all of the humor.
There's humor. Whimsy. It's just
it's
really
just horrible.
Horrible humor. Kraken was a decent book. That's like a bit more, you know, family friendly.
No.
But
well,
Squid.
It was not as like dramatically horrible.
No, not Scar. Not Scar. I'm talking about the.
I read Kraken.
You did read Kraken?
Yes, I read Kraken.
With the Star Trek wizard?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't even know you read that.
Yes.
And the Tattoo Man?
Maybe I don't know. Did I read Kraken or did I read this?
Did you read the one where they're all in a boat or did you want to read the one? Yeah, that's Scar.
Oh, okay.
Kraken is the one that is sort of like Neverwhere meets American Gods.
Okay, maybe.
Eh?
In my precious last few months of being able to ever read anything again, maybe I will read it.
Maybe I don't want to have that pressure on me. maybe you should just stick to reading, like, I don't know, some more Jane Austen.
But yeah, I think it is like it's two different ways of approaching it. I think you see that those darker moments as a way of actually entering into a deeper conversation about morality and the human condition, and I just find them too disturbing, and I would rather have something more uplifting
or surround yourself with a slightly more upbeat existence.
Yeah.
I think that's fair.
So, I mean, I don't think either of those is an inappropriate Christian response to the world of media.
Yeah.
They're just two different ways of looking at it.
And it's going to be interesting.
I prefer to see people functioning better than they are.
And I prefer reality.
Why don't you tell our dear audience how you wanted Harry Potter to
end? I had the greatest ending for Harry Potter. All right, so this was my Harry Potter final book. Chapter 1, page 1. Harry defeats Voldemort. That's it. So just get that out of the way. It's still going to be like 800 pages. Don't worry. But what the next 800 pages are going to chronicle is the fact that now that Voldemort is defeated, Harry Potter is not just going to have like some magical existence for the rest of his life. He has no purpose now. His entire life up to this point has been about, you know, achieving this great sort of task, and now it's done. So he's just going to like bounce around from unfulfilling task to unfulfilling task, filling his life with self-medication and just alienating all the people in his life until my very final page where it's just Ron Weasley at the door of this dilapidated flat looking at his friend lying on the ground saying, "I just can't watch you do this to yourself, Harry." Door shuts. The end.
And the title is?
Harry Potter and the Inevitable Decline into Mediocrity.
Excellent.
But see, that's a whole other thing about how, like, I think Umbridge is, like, the greatest villain in Harry Potter because she's such a sort of banal villain. You know, she's so creepy because she's so, you know, she believes what she's doing is right.
Yeah.
And she's willing to sacrifice for that sense of right. Ooh. Nothing Voldemort did, snake-wise or otherwise, is as creepy as I must never tell lies.
Right.
Now, this whole conversation is going to be a lot more interesting when we gain our junior partner in the fall.
Right.
And while I don't know if we're going to have to, you know, have a full discussion, a list of what we are and are not going to allow our child to watch, I think I'm pushing for showing Dark Crystal as soon as possible.
Well, I think we both agree that it's very important to traumatize your child with the fantasy movies of the 1980s.
Well, yes.
Because it will make them stronger.
Yes, they have
to
be
strong. And we coddle our children today.
Yes.
So I think that, you know, the Dark Crystal and
Black
Cauldron and The Last Unicorn will be very early viewing.
Good. Excellent. At least in that, we are agreed.
Yes.
Well, everyone, from the world of faith, family, and fandom, in no particular order, geek out.
And Klingon, it's Kapaha, which sort of sounds like a threat. Aijalau is Romulan, but not exactly canon, in case we make the fanboys upset. Nikartele Gardarasim is Mandalorian.